When you have an episode that causes that type of stress, folks are largely going to be looking to their financial services provider for an understanding of their financial wherewithal, but also just a general understanding of broader implications for the economy.
That stress is in reference to the banking sector, which saw the collapse of three major banks in the first 5 months of 2023, Silicon Valley, Signature, and First Republic.
Mostly they failed because of bad investments, but it wasn't so much the money that they were putting money in, it was how they invested the money.
I'm Bailey Friday, and Texas wants to know, when a bank collapses, what happens to your money?
Well, I mean, it's terrible when a bank fails. I mean, it's just the worst thing that can happen. And it just dredges up all the insecurities and anxieties in people. And in this case, a lot of small businesses, a lot of startup businesses, a lot of Silicon Valley businesses, because it's just sort of unthinkable. You know, you put your money in, you think it's always there when you want to go get it. That's why you put it in a bank. If not, you'd, you know, give it to your brother-in-law, bury it in the backyard or something like that.
That's David Johnson. He's been the business analyst at News Radio 1080 KRLD in Dallas for more than 40 years.
When you put it in a bank, the idea is that it's going to be there. So it really is sobering, and it's shocking when that doesn't happen.
Silicon Valley Bank, which is headquartered in Santa Clara, California, was the first to fail. It collapsed on March 10th. New York-based Signature Bank collapsed 2 days later. According to Reuters, the latter lost 20% of its deposits in just hours on the day SVB failed and closed on March 12th after it lost $42 billion in a single day. When we hear that a bank has failed or collapsed, it generally means it does not have the assets to meet its obligations to its depositors. That's according to the FDIC. It's something that longtime observers of the industry in Texas have firsthand experience with. In the 1980s, the state lost almost all of its banks.
All the savings and loans went under. And they were mostly making a lot of what turned out to be pretty aggressive loans on real estate. And real estate's great as long as it keeps going up, because if the guy didn't pay you, you know, you can turn around and sell the real estate. Well, what happens if they don't pay you and the real estate goes down in value? All of a sudden, you lose money. A one-off, that's going to happen. But what about when every loan turns bad? And that's what happened then. And it really was very sobering, and it paved the way for all of these outside banks. In fact, we didn't have interstate banking. We only had intrastate banks at the time. And it brought in the J.P. Morgan Chases and Wells Fargo's and Bank of America's and everybody else to us.
So if that's what caused so many banks to fail in the 80s, what happened this time around?
You know, a bank gets money from you and they have to do something with it. A certain amount of it has to be put away and you put it in bonds. Well, you buy U.S. Treasuries and there are 30-year bonds that are paying a lot. And under the assumption that you're not going to need the money right away. Well, all of a sudden there's a run on the bank and you need the money. Well, if you bought bonds that at the time were paying 3%, which was a great deal, and all of a sudden the Fed's been jacking up interest rates for the year, and 3% bonds are not very attractive anymore, nobody wants to buy them. And so your investment, Mr. Bank, that you paid $100,000 for, getting 3%, if you want to sell them, you might have to sell them for $50,000. And that's exactly what happened with Silicon Valley. They had a run on the bank. Everybody wanted their money at once. And they had to sell their collateral. And when they did, it wasn't worth as much as they needed. And the bank failed.
I have something that, you know, we learned during the 80s that you mentioned is that, and I've said this time and time again, that the only liquidity you have in a crisis is the liquidity you bring to the crisis. You know, and so you better have some.
Phil Green is the chairman and CEO of San Antonio-based Frost Bank.
You go into a crisis like what happened with Silicon Valley, and you go into that crisis with only lending out about a little less than 40% of your deposits, and you have 20% of your deposit base in a checking account at the Federal Reserve. I mean, that's when those things pay off. And so that's what our job was, and that's what we did.
Silicon Valley Bank was acquired by First Citizens Bank, while Flagstar Bank took over Signature. First Republic Bank collapsed about 7 weeks later, on May 1st. Federal regulators ultimately took control of First Republic and sold it to JP Morgan Chase, the largest bank in the country. So if that's what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, what happened at First Republic and Signature?
One official said this was the cell phone collapse. So what are you talking about? He said, well, it's so easy to move money around right now. You start hearing a rumor or somebody tells you, maybe you ought to get this, you know, this bank, I'm not so sure. Maybe you ought to get your money out. Well, I mean, all you do is you reach, you don't have to call anybody, you don't fill out paperwork, you don't have to go down, get all dressed up in a suit and tie and go down to the bank. You pick up your cell phone and literally touch a few keys, bam, out goes the money. And that's what everybody did. And they did it all at once. And some of the officials said, you know, this was the social media collapse of the banks, the rumor, and it's just spread like wildfire. And it was so easy to move money that it all went.
All three banks catered to wealthier clients, with many accounts holding more than $250,000, the limit to what it federally insured. According to a May 1st AP story, clients withdrew more than $100 billion in early March after the collapses of SVB and Signature Bank. However, experts we talked to say they don't expect it to be the start of a larger collapse.
It appears that the domino has been arrested when they came in and said, we're going to make these banks good. Don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. It seemed to calm. But boy, I tell you, it reminds you, you know, how important something like that is, how, you know, faith, how having that level of confidence, how important it is and how quickly you could lose it. To lose three banks to a great degree because of social media, I mean, that's just, it's unthinkable. It certainly was unthinkable 10 years ago. And I guess it's something we have to think about now.
Yeah, I think over the last few years, we've seen that a collective faith or set of norms and expectations that we all follow are kind of necessary for society to function, right?
Exactly. The power of social media, I mean, we've seen it in all sorts of things, rumors that have been started, you know, about politicians or individuals or bullying. My gosh, you know, kids get bullied, you know, on social media. I mean, the power is just amazing. I don't know that it's always going to be like that. My sense is things like this sort of ebb and flow, but then you start seeing it, you know, work financial institutions. That's amazing. That's a level of awareness that officials at major banks have to be aware of that they probably never were beforehand. Everybody else, you know, our bank, we need to project safety and stability. And that's why banks were always built with big columns and lots of flags and stuff like that. But boy, that stuff becomes more important now.
There have been two major banking crises in the U.S. since the FDIC was created after the Great Depression. That's according to Pew Research. The first was the one we talked about in the mid-1980s. The second time was in 2008 and 2009.
The most recent experience for the U.S. as a whole was the Great Recession. That was more of a credit-driven event.
Matt Scurlock is the CFO of Dallas-based Texas Capital Bank.
So you had some poor underwriting decisions by a select number of institutions that bled to more of a collective set of poor underwriting decisions across the industry that resulted in credit events and capital implications.
How is this event different than the one we experienced 15 years ago?
This one was much more of a sort of acute liquidity event. So you had a pretty specific cohort of banks that had observable characteristics that I don't really see that in a lot of other institutions across the industry right now. A set of observable characteristics where their liabilities, which would be the client's deposits, began to reprice much faster than their assets, which are generally going to be client loans, securities, or cash, which is generally how banks fail. So as those liabilities are repricing faster than their assets, you had a mismatch, which caused SVB to have to take a loss, realize a loss in the securities portfolio, which sort of set off the events that occurred that second, third week of March.
Now, I'm no expert on the banking industry, but Scurlock explains that the ways banks ensure they don't fail might be similar to how we handle our own money, just in larger amounts.
Most banks are going to try to keep some excess cash for when things don't go exactly as anticipated. And that amount of excess cash, which sometimes in banking referred to capital or liquidity, is going to be dependent on the specific bank and their specific strategy. we want to hold a lot. So one of our fundamental principles is that we want to be financial resilient, which means we can access markets, serve clients, and support communities through any rate cycle. So we're going to hold capital and liquidity well in excess of certainly what's required by the regulators, but of well in excess of what we would think of as sort of predictable or standard events, and just be there with pure confidence for clients and prospects when the unexpected event happens, which typically happens more than you think it's going to.
Did Frost do anything differently after it saw all these bank failures this spring?
We had planned to buy some securities. We decided we're just going to wait on those. And we'll just let liquidity build up and let's kind of see what happens to rates and see what happens to the balance sheet. That was the most strategic thing, was just to say, hey, we're going to pause and not buy anything. But the work had been done really in the years before.
Scurlock says one of the balances publicly traded financial institutions have to strike is keeping enough cash on hand for clients versus delivering returns to shareholders.
It's in some ways a net negative to short-term earnings to hold excess capital or hold excess liquidity. A lot of the quality financial services firms are those that are going to hold it irrespective of the short-term demands of an investor, because they know that over time, how you build a valuable franchise is being there to support your clients through all cycles. And they know the cycles are going to occur all the time.
Is there anything different or unique about Texas and about its economy that makes it different from banking in other states?
This is what I believe about Texas. Texas is a very relational state and state of mind. And I think we do build relationships. And I think that I will say this, you can't build a bank on scared money. And Texas wasn't built on scared money. There's a wholesomeness of people coming together and trusting bankers who have sound judgment to put these things together, put their money together with others, and make these economies grow. I think Texas is comfortable with that. I think we've got a raft of small community banks that believe in that and help with that. You know, so I think that's somewhat unique about Texas. And everyone knows it's the best business environment in the world. I'd put it up against anyone. I don't think you get much argument on that. And so I think all that together makes Texas a little bit different.
I don't know that I would tie it bank failures specifically to the geography. I think it's more of just a balance sheet management case study. I think banks in Texas are just as fortunate as anyone who lives in Texas to call the state home. We benefit from, in my view, the most robust economy in the U.S. I mean, we're now the ninth largest economy in the world. Texas is the biggest exporter in the country. We got 15 tier one universities on the I-35 corridor. You know all the stats. I think that the backdrop here is highly conducive to Texas-based banks continuing to deliver an outsized value to Texas-based businesses. And that's a role that we take very seriously and one that we're really proud to be in.
What would you recommend to people who are worried about having money in a bank?
You know, you need to kind of figure out where your money is and how it's insured. And, you know, the insurance laws are really pretty liberal. I mean, you get, you know, $250,000 insurance in your name, $250,000 insurance in your wife's name, $250,000 insurance in joint name. So you can spread it around, or you just spread it around among banks. But you've got FDIC insurance, which I think is good insurance. And that's always going to be there.
Just in case you didn't know, because I didn't, FDIC stands for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It was created in 1933. Johnson says some in our nation's capital are floating the idea of insuring 100% of the money in U.S. banks.
There's a good argument for that, which is that people won't lose their money, you know, and they all vote and they're all good people and they shouldn't be losing their money because somebody made a stupid investment that they didn't have anything to do with. The other side is that it can encourage bad investments. You know, the bank can say, well, you know, we might as well take the money and put it on this guy that's, got a new electric flying car, and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but look, you know, it's insured. Maybe that's not the thing to do either. So this is part of the debate that's going on right now while we're picking up the pieces.
We need to, as a country, as an industry, as investors, as policymakers, we need to get over this stigmatization of uninsured deposits. And yes, there can, like anything else, it can go to seed and you can have too much with the wrong customer base. But you know, you can't expect regional banks who support these economies we're in, that if someone wants to develop something in Dallas, it's a great resort, it's going to create jobs, and it's going to be a $50 million deal. What are we supposed to do? Cobble together all these $250,000 savings account, loan it to this guy? What are these people supposed to do when they want to get a mortgage and they want to improve their homes? I mean, and the fact is, we're loaning that uninsured deposit money back to these large depositors.
So what are the odds of a collapse like that happening to a Texas bank?
I was talking about the likelihood of this California thing being replicated in Texas. And one of the things that was pointed out to me, and I think it was true, is that, remember, this happened in Texas in the 80s. It wiped out all the banks, all the savings and loans. And there are a lot of those people who are still around. And then we had another little dose of it in 08 and 09, but Texas fared a lot better. And the reason is because they'd learned their lesson and were not as aggressive and watched the bottom line a little bit closer. So the argument is that we're not, nobody's immune to this. But because of that collective memory, that it makes it less likely.
I know the industry is more stabilized than they were back in the panic that occurred right after Silicon Valley. So I would say, yes, it is stable. As I said earlier, today it's really about what's the impact on your profitability margins as you compete for deposits in a higher rate environment. And I think that's what banks are figuring out.
One thing to me that just fuels Texan, that Green and Scurlock both talked about, is the person-to-person relationships they've built.
SVB failed on Friday morning. By that Sunday evening, we were on a call with all of our senior leaders and top bankers with a plan to go into market that Monday morning and interact with clients and prospects. And really important component of that interaction is that the dialogue was not about us, it's about the client. You have the financial wherewithal to, in those moments of stress, offer your support, offer your advice for clients that may be looking to take advantage of any dislocation, let alone, you know, assuage any sort of concern they have about the industry as a whole.
I talked to, you know, two or three customers, and I remember talking to one of them. I gave him like three data points. The data points I gave you also pointed out that insiders were buying. And he said, "Phil, you know, I really appreciate that. Thanks for giving me those numbers, but I really just like hearing the sound of your voice. And, you know, it's it makes me feel so much better." And I think that's true. You know, we'd equipped our bankers. You talked about, you know, how we talk to our customers. We equipped them to know those facts about us. So when customers did call, or when we were proactive, and actually I think we ended up calling more customers than called us. At least I know that. That's the report I've gotten back. They were confident. And they heard that same sound of their voice and our people when they talked. And I think that's really been true, you know, with the community banking industry and in this state and really in Main Street all over the place.
So give me your expert opinion. What do you think the future of the industry looks like?
I'm very optimistic about the regional bank and community bank business model. I think that they're critical for the health of our country. The system we have takes a lot of probity because you're signing up to be a fiduciary with these depositors and the lenders that need to use the money. And I think it ought to be held as a profession that ought to be held in high regard. It takes a lot of discipline to do it. But I think we ought to not become so frightened that we throw out the baby of this system where we've got prudent bankers and regulators that are professional and do their job and come alongside us whenever you may, you know, when you get outside the lines and put you back in there and make those good decisions. All that is a very wholesome system that's helped make this economy the best in the world. And we ought to not throw it out with the bathwater of some specialized, unusual situations that tragically happened.
Going forward, unfortunately, I think it means that the banks are going to be less aggressive in their lending and not take as many chances. And when they do invest their assets, they're not going to invest them long term, which probably means that the cost of borrowing money for your small startup business, for the, you know, the widget business, is going to cost more. It's going to raise the cost for everybody. It also means that small businesses and individuals alike suddenly start remembering that FDIC sticker that you see on the front of the bank and note the importance of it and the comfort of that.
our strategy is really centered on Texas-based businesses and the employees and executives that comprise them. So we feel like we're in a pretty unique spot in terms of a strategy of having a full-service financial services firm that I think fits the needs of both the business landscape today as well as in the future.
I'm Bailey Friday at News Radio 1080 KRLD in Dallas-Fort Worth. Thank you so much for joining me for Texas Wants to Know. If you liked the show, please give us a rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode was written and produced by Savannah Jones and Chris Blake with editorial support from Cooper Mall and original music by Michael Eisenstein. Odyssey's managing producer for National News Podcasts is Myron Kaplan.